Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the Central Asian Focus newsletter. Russia is criticizing Central Asia and mistreating Central Asian migrant laborers seeking work in Russia with increasing frequency. Irredentist claims, lecturing about history, complaining about how Russia is seen and portrayed in Central Asia are becoming common commentary from Russian officials. But Central Asian officials started responding recently, criticizing Russia for interference in their internal affairs and demanding Russia show more respect towards Central Asian citizens working in Russia. To discuss all this, I am joined by Edward Lemon, the president of the Washington-based Oxa Society for Central Asian Affairs, and Fran Olmos, a senior researcher in Central Asian Affairs at Spain's Geopol 21 Center and research fellow at the London-based Foreign Policy Center. Thank you both for joining me. Edward, I'd like to start with the treatment of migrant laborers in Central Asian migrant laborers in Russia. And Tajikistan's prime minister just addressed this issue. Tajikistan's been very quiet about any criticism from Russia. But so it was very interesting that the prime minister actually called out Russia for mistreatment of migrant laborers. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I think for many years, Tajik officials there was almost a moratorium on talking too much about migration. Each year, Rahmon would talk about all of the great things that the government was doing to help develop the economy, but he wouldn't recognize the fact that the country is so addicted to migration. From figures from last year's remittances, money sent back primarily from Russia indicates that almost half of the economy is based on migration. But in recent years, as you said, recent months, we've seen the government increasingly drawing attention to the mistreatment of migrants from Central Asia, from Tajikistan in Russia. And the Prime Minister's recent comments is just the last in a series of comments, primarily from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to highlight and draw attention to some of the restrictions that migrants have been facing, particularly in the wake of the Crocus attack, Crocus City Hall attack in Moscow back in March, that of course was blamed on four Tajik nationals. And since then, we've seen an uptick in violence and repression against migrants that I'm sure we'll discuss later, that has caused this response.
Let me just follow up a little bit. Azadi, RFARL's Tajik service, reported that 17,000 Tajik citizens were deported from Russia in the first half of this year. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think deportations have certainly been on the rise. And this recent migration legislation that was just introduced in Russia that also speeds up and eases that process of deportation. Before, had to go through the court system. Took around 90 days. Now the police can make that decision rather than courts, and it can take under 48 hours. So that process of deportation has been sped up. And obviously for the Russian government, there's a need to signal to its domestic population that it's cracking down on migration, because for many migrants in Russia are seen as we discussed on the podcast recently, are seen as inferior, as potential terrorists, as criminals, in ways that we've seen migrants framed around the world. And so we've seen that increase in deportations really as a response to the Crocus City Hall attack.
Okay, thank you. Fran, it's not just Tajikistan, of course. I mean, both the Tajik and Kyrgyz governments have warned their citizens about traveling to Russia anyway. But Kyrgyzstan, for instance, is in kind of a different category than the big three, for lack of a better term, Central Asian countries that contribute migrant laborers to Russia, where migrant laborers are coming to work in Russia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. Now, at the start of August, the deputy chairman of the parliament in Kyrgyzstan, the government, excuse me, Adil Baysalov, said that, considering the treatment of Kyrgyz citizens who are migrant laborers in Russia, what's the point of being in this Eurasian Economic Union? Can you tell us a little bit about the treatment of Kyrgyz laborers, too, since technically they should be in a different category than Uzbek or Tajik citizens?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, technically they should be different because their country is part of the Eurasian Economic Union. But, what it's in paper and what the reality that they face in Russia in terms of the discrimination, racism, and other practices, I mean, it differs little or nothing, regardless of their country's status. So, you know, while from a legal perspective, there's differences also the time when to do paperwork and the bureaucracy and the permits and all the rest, the actual attitude they get from Russian officials and from the population there, it's no different, right? And, you know, last month, so shortly after those comments, Dmitry Medvedev, the former Russian president, made other comments regarding migrants. Again, not specifying any particular country, I believe. I think it was just saying situation migrants in general, saying that they should not, and I quote, take their 3 wives and 9 children to Russia when they were seasonal migrants, right? So, you know, he didn't specify, I don't believe, a nationality there, but that points to the fact that, you know, regardless of a country is part of the Eurasian Economic Union or other Russian-led organizations, the treatment that they get at a personal level from the authorities or from society is pretty much the same. So, yeah, there's not much distinctions there, I would say.
Okay, and just so we can clear up for the audience what the kind of things that they're objecting to, right? Let's start. Edward had mentioned that after the Krokus City Hall attack in March, things got much worse. Fran, can you, and I'll get from both of you, but Fran, can you tell me a little bit about what's different about trying to enter Russia now? If you're from Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, or Uzbekistan, you get to the airport and what happens?
So, I mean, again, because I'm not the best position probably to mention that from, but we hear from the reports, first of all, the border control is much more strict, with her reports of people not being let into the country as they were before. And then, like Edward said, when it came to regulation, they recently amended, they can be deported much more easily. So they're already facing trouble there at the actual border. And then, let alone then trying to get the work permits, avoiding any sort of confrontation with authorities, being drafted for the war in Ukraine, so on and so forth. So, I mean, it was already not the easiest of experiences, but in the last couple of months, since the Krokus City Hall attacks, it's become tougher for those migrants looking to make a living in Russia.
Thank you. Edward, same question, but also noting that a lot of these people are being held at the Russian airport when they get into the country, right? And then, and some of them are put on a plane and sent back after being held at airports in Russia.
Yeah, we've certainly seen an uptick in the number of people being denied entry to the country. Obviously, lots of reports of lengthy waits to get into the country, sometimes lasting days and then resulting in people not actually being let into the country. We've seen an uptick in deportations. We've seen an uptick in raids against migrant locations where a large number of migrants work. Various different agricultural businesses work, building sites and so on and so forth. So really this is about the government of Russia performing this crackdown on migration to appease its domestic population. And obviously that domestic population has also been involved in many of these reprisals, data from the server center, that collects kind of data on xenophobic violence pointed to an uptick since March, or in the months following March, April, May, and a doubling in the number of incidents of online harassment or posts that were calling for xenophobic violence against migrants. So we've certainly seen, you know, the public also becoming part of this crackdown on migration.
Okay, thank you. And to get back to Prime Minister Russell-Zada's statement, he also mentioned, and you just touched on it too, that there's the increasing recruitment of labor migrants from Tajikistan. And this, of course, applies to the other Central Asian countries too. But can you tell me a little bit about that? Is it increasing, the recruitment of Central Asian migrant laborers?
To the war in Ukraine?
Yeah, exactly. Well, recruitment into the Russian military. But yes, I think a lot of them end up in Ukraine.
Yeah, I think that this is a very complex issue, and I think Tajik citizens are particularly vulnerable because they are allowed to have dual citizenship, and they've been taking up dual citizenship in increasing numbers. So many of those people are dual nationals, and therefore, because of their Russian citizenship, they are therefore eligible for drafting into the Russian military. But we also have lots of evidence of others being offered pathways to citizenship being, in other cases, arrested and threatened with deportation unless they serve in the Russian military. And in other cases, you know, we have a lot of migrants also being drafted into roles or recruited into roles, non-military roles, but rebuilding parts of the occupied territories in Ukraine. So really, yeah, we've certainly seen this nexus between increasing repression and that being used as a tool to increase recruitment to the Russian military. And I think Tajiks seem particularly vulnerable. But, you know, we've seen this across the board with other migrant groups as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. All right, let's get into the war of words that's been developing here. And we'll start with Uzbekistan since they've been the most vocal friend. Tell us, I mean, recently we just had another problem with statements coming out of Russia that were not warmly received, I'll say, in Uzbekistan. Can you tell me about some of the cases? And I guess we start with the school case and with the Russian language.
Sure. So what happened was, to in a nutshell, a teacher, physically abused, or a student who requested to learn the language class in Russian. Now, there was a video that went sort of viral. So the spokesman of the Russian Foreign Ministry, Maria Zakharova, she made a comment saying that Uzbekistan should address that issue, should investigate into what happened. Now, of course, the fact that, you know, a spokesman or spokeswoman in this case of the Russian Foreign Ministry has to relate to a very specific case that happened in a school in Tashkent, you know, between a teacher and a student, raised the eyebrows. And, you know, the first one to address this was none other than Alisher Kadyrov, who is an Uzbek politician, leader of National Revival Party, he used to be a presidential candidate, and he's known for his outspoken remarks, you know, nationalist in tone. But he was the first one to sort of jump at that and pretty much told the Russian authorities that, you know, they have the issues of their own. So it'd be better if they focus on their own problems rather than get involved in Uzbekistan's own internal affairs. And similarly, Rasul Kusherbayev, who is an advisor to the Ministry of National Resources in Uzbekistan, I believe, also said that Zakharova, who made these remarks, should be in topping the list of non-welcome, non-desired people in Uzbekistan. So they took a quite firm stance of what could be seen, and it's, I think, quite obvious as interference on Uzbekistan's own internal affairs. And again, a very specific case in a specific school. So we're not talking about even like high politics here or high geopolitics, but a total domestic, even local and rather national issue. So they were the first ones to jump at this. I mean, Kadyrov is not the first time he makes these sort of remarks when Russian officials or personalities make comments about Uzbekistan. I mean, early in the year, a Russian historian also made another comment about Uzbekistan, saying it had not existed. I believe it was before the 1917 revolution, the Uzbek as a people, among, and also Kazakhs and Azeris. And again, Kadyrov said, replied to that, lamenting that Amir Timur or Tamerlane had not taken Moscow when he had the chance. So it's not the first time we see these remarks, but it's quite telling that maybe if this happened years ago, we maybe would not have heard anything coming out of Tashkent. But even though now that's changed, and we do hear, I mean, of course, there's very specific officials, and Kadyrov is kind of always, you know, the spokesperson, let's say unofficial for these sort of remarks, but it's telling that it's actually happening, because he would not do it, let's say, without some high level blessing. So that's the latest spat that's happened. You know, the school, I think it was last month, if I'm not mistaken, so quite recently, but it just adds up to a list of other remarks from Russia, nationalist remarks, or trying to interfere into domestic affairs. And we can discuss a bit, a few other examples, but that's the most recent one that we've seen.
Okay, yeah, and we will discuss some more of these examples in just a second, but I want to make clear too that it's sad but a true fact that in Uzbekistan actually teachers beating students is not as rare as one would hope. There have been videos of teachers hitting school kids, and not just in Uzbekistan, but in other Central Asian countries. But it was just this one incident involving the Russian language that Zakharov was talking about, right? You didn't say it's bad to have violence in school. Just this one thing, right?
When any Central Asian country puts in a law, approves a law, for instance, to promote its own language, national language, Russia, the Russian authorities see Russian as something they need to protect. And whether that's from a regulation point of view, or whether this specific case, when it's in a school in the capital of Uzbekistan, they're always jumping at the occasion of to protect in their view or interfere. But when they seem to be very defensive when it comes to Russian language, and reminding that pretty much they're looking, and any movement against Russian language, even if it's something as symbolic and small in scale as what we've seen last month, they will not let it pass, and they will make any sort of remarks and make their minds clear.
Okay, thank you. Let's stick with school and move on to Tajikistan and history in particular. Russian Duma deputy Mikhail Matveyev recently posted information that questioned the way that Tajikistan is teaching history of Russia's presence in Central Asia. And that also sparked a response from Tajikistan. Can you carry me through this story, Edward?
Yeah. And so this was another relatively recent case where the deputy Matveyev criticized the way in which expansion of Russia into Central Asia and to Tajikistan in particular was framed as an invasion, was framed as a foreign occupation, was framed in imperial terms, which is an accurate representation of what was happening at the time. But of course, to Russia, they have this, what Erika Marat and Botikos Gassenbecher have called this imperial innocence. They don't think of themselves as being historically an empire. They were an elder brother. They came and they brought benefits to the people of Central Asia. It wasn't a traditional colonial relationship. It was one that benefited people on the ground. And so this interpretation continues. And in this latest case, we had some pushback from the Tajik side. We saw Shohin Sarandi, who is the head of the Information Department in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, saying, well, look at your textbooks that teach history. I think it's the ninth grade. They talk about a genocide of Russians in Tajikistan during the Tajik Civil War that broke out in 1992. At the time of independence, about 10% of the Tajik population was ethnically Russian. And during the course of the Civil War, many of those people did leave the country because they migrated to Russia and elsewhere because of the difficult situation facing the country at that time. But to frame it as genocide is not an accurate characterization, because no such genocide existed. And some of the indirectly criticized that and said that was inciting hatred and was just aimed at sowing discord and anti-Tajik feelings. So in this case, they turned what Russia claimed to be an inaccurate representation of history in Tajikistan on its head, and said that, well, the Russians are mischaracterizing the period of the civil war in Tajikistan. So again, more evidence, like Fran mentioned, of pushback against some of these more chauvinistic and inaccurate narratives from the Russian Federation.
Oh, thank you. Fran, to get back to Uzbekistan and their history, you'd mentioned that they had this Russian, Mikhail Smolin, I believe his name was, allegedly a historian in Russia, who had said that the Uzbek people didn't exist until the Bolshevik Revolution, which contradicts their own famous anthropologist, Bartold, who wrote a seminal work on that and mentioned the Uzbeks years before the Bolshevik Revolution. But it's not just that, right? There's been some pushback in Uzbekistan against particularly Soviet history. And we get back to Alisher Kadyrov. He's had says that Uzbekistan should have a totally and extremely negative view of Soviet history. Is this true?
Yeah, he said this. Later, he remarked that he's not a Russophobe, but rather a Sovietphobe. I mean, all the things that Kadyrov said, we always have to, you know, take with a pinch of salt because it can be quite strombotic. But yeah, I mean, he's remarked his opposition to the Soviet Union. There was some issues some weeks ago where there were a couple. There was one individual or a couple with a Soviet flag in, you know, trying to reclaim the Soviet past of Uzbekistan, and they got in trouble with authorities. And he made those remarks also, which you know, the Soviets had invaded Uzbekistan and so on and so forth. So we have seen that from in that sense. I mean, it's, but there is, that follows to a large extent an official line that has started a couple of years ago in Uzbekistan from the government, of course, much more politically correct. But we've seen a rehabilitation of different personalities, hundreds of people persecuted by the Soviet authorities, Bolshevik authorities in the 20s and 30s. So there, I mean, while Kadyrov might give the more, let's say, sensationalistic, more you know, outspoken approach to that, not politically correct, but it does fall into a new trend, and that's a bit of a separate conversation. But we're do seeing the rehabilitation of people repressed by the Soviets in Uzbekistan and also elsewhere. So, you know, the way he says it and how he portrays it is very, let's say, he has no filter, which is also part of his style. But, you know, there's some sort of truth behind what he's saying. But, I mean, again, this is one particular politician, but he's always in charge of making these remarks. You could say a bit of a testing the waters to see the reaction. That would be my view on that. But yeah, we're seeing a revision of the Soviet past also as a colonization, as an invasion. And, you know, this is seen in Kadyrov's very bombastic remarks, but it's nothing new in the last couple of years. But the more we see the Russian authorities, officials, or people related to the Kremlin make these nationalist remarks, their actions are having a reaction. And I think that's the most important and significant part. Whoever does it doesn't really matter, in the sense that if there's a reaction, it's because that reaction is allowed to happen. So I think we'll see some sort of self-national assertiveness in this regard vis-a-vis Russia.
Okay, thank you. Edward, of course, it's not just, or at least part of the history that Russia often objects to, let me put it that way, part of the history that Russia often objects to is the demolition of former Russian or Soviet buildings. I mean, it's down to that level. And even the changing of names of settlements around the country. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course, all the central republics have been adopting various policies to strengthen their own national languages and to, particularly in the case of Tajikistan, change the name and Tajikify. So it's not even just aimed at Russia. It's also aimed at various settlements, even Uzbek or other titles that are outside the Tajik language. So it's a general policy or effort to build distinct national identity, one that's often controlled from above. And Russia, of course, has taken exception to that. I think on the issue of historic buildings, of course, this isn't purely being driven by the government and by the Russian government. This opposition, there are, of course, indigenous opposition movements, and there are locals who are opposed to this dismantlement of what they perceive to be you know, important parts of the history, you know, tea rooms like the Rohat Tea Room on Rudovsky Avenue, Dushanbe, for example, that's slated for demolishment, although it was built during the Soviet Union. You know, it's viewed as being an architectural gem for Dushanbe. So some of this opposition is, you know, is genuine, but certainly Russia frames it as part of a broader dismantlement of the Soviet legacy, which, of course, they view as being linked to the attempts to undermine Russia's contemporary role in the region.
Thanks. And Fran, I'd like to get your opinion on that, too. Remembering that it was just 2 months ago that Kyrgyzstan, a little more than that, that Kyrgyzstan announced it was going to demolish the Panfilov Division Museum, which nobody had been taken care of in decades and was just falling apart. But that also elicited some criticism from Russia. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the demolition of Russian/Soviet-era buildings.
Yeah, I mean, because the way Russia, Russian authorities see Central Asia is still as their near abroad or their zone of influence. And as I had mentioned before, they don't see themselves as a colonizer, rather than, you know, that big brother that gave them all the goods and education and so on. So anything that has to do with demolishing whether statues or buildings or renaming, it's not well received in Russia, because they, I guess from their point of view, they're seeing these countries, which they believe should own allegiance to Moscow, moving away and asserting their own national independence. And the renaming of cities, I mean, I think mostly happened to a large extent following independence. But then there are still monuments to either Russian historical figures, or like that particular museum that you mentioned, or to Soviet war efforts and Second World War memorials and the like. So it's a way of by doing this, they're, at least from a symbolic point of view, they're asserting their independence, which of course Moscow doesn't like. I mean, there's other things which are not tangible per se, which, like for instance, the victory day parade for the Great Priority War, as they call it, but the Second World War, and some countries are not holding that anymore, related also to Ukraine conflict. But these other sort of events, which are not buildings and not physical features of the cities, but that's also a way where we see these countries are independent. And Russia doesn't like it, because, like I said, they still consider these countries as their own sphere of influence. And anything that goes beyond that, asserting their independence, they it seems like they cannot understand, they cannot accept that happening. So they will raise complaints, whether it's language related, Russian language related, whether it's monuments, buildings, cities, anything to do with these regions, Russian colonial past or Soviet colonial past, they will step up and raise their voices. In some cases, they're just complaints that nothing else happens, and the demolition or the changing of the city or whatever the action goes on regardless, because they're, to a large extent, they're for us a symbolical nature.
Okay, thank you. And a reminder, we're talking about Central Asian patience for Russian criticism running thin, and my guests are Fran Olmos, a senior researcher in Central Asian affairs at Spain's Geopol 21 Center and research fellow at the London-based Foreign Policy Center, and Edward Lemon, president of the Washington-based Oxus Society for Central Asian Affairs. Thank you much. You know, let's get a little deeper into this. What is all this doing to the relationship between these two countries? I mean, I suppose in a weird way, you could argue that this is actually helping Central Asia's independence, you know, because Russia is supposed to be a partner and a friend, and yet you get all this criticism and the bad treatment of Central Asian migrant laborers working in Russia. So what is the relation? What is this doing to the relationship between the Central Asian states and Russia? Edward, I'll start with you.
Well, I think when we compare attitudes to Russia and China, historically, we've always characterized the relationship between China and Central Asia as warm politics, cold politics, right? I.e., the relationships between the elites were very strong, but relationships between the peoples were weaker. There's a lot of xenophobic sentiments present in Central Asia. And I wonder if, with regards to Russia, we're moving in the same direction. Certainly, with regards to data from the Central Asia Barometer, which unfortunately recently had to close down due to pressure from the governments in the region, but was doing some amazing polling work. With regards to Kazakhstan, for example, polling data from 2017 would point to 5% of people having negative attitudes towards Russia. And data from their latest wave would point to 33% of people in Kazakhstan having negative attitudes towards Russia. And I break out some of that data by age, and the vast majority of under 30s have negative attitudes towards Russia. And on the other side, the vast majority of over 15s have positive attitudes towards Russia. So there's this generational shift, and I think with the ongoing war in Ukraine and, you know, the decolonization movement, we'll see a potentially increasing negative attitudes from the public. So I think that's been, for me, one of the main consequences of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. for Russia's influence in Central Asia. But although in many ways its influence in certain sectors has increased or stayed steady, particularly in its relations with the public in Central Asia, it's become much weaker. Its societal influence has been a lot more pushback from the public, but also the governments of the region seem to discuss responding to that more negative public sentiment. I think it's particularly strong in Kazakhstan, as I mentioned. But it's also there in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan as well.
Thanks. You know, thank you for mentioning the Central Asian barometer also. Let's talk about them for just a second, because they were very diplomatically quiet about who was pressuring them exactly. But as you mentioned, a lot of their polls had to do with people's perception of Russia. Do you think that there was, Russia puts pressure on the Central Asian governments in a lot of ways. Do you think that this was provoked by something in Russia? And they told the Central Asian governments that these guys, Central Asia Barometer, had to go?
I mean, my understanding, and I think it'd be great to have an entire episode on academic freedom on research in the region, because there's a lot of important developments that are restricting the ability of us to understand the region, which is so important. My understanding was, in part, there was pressure from the outside related to countries like China and Russia being upset that their data pointed to such trends as increasing Sinophobia, at least up until 2022, and now since 2022, increasing anti-Russian sentiments. So I think there's definitely a sensitivity we can clearly see from the Russian side to this this trend that looks set to only increase in future years.
Okay, thank you. Fran, of course, all the Central Asian presidents were just there for Russian President Vladimir Putin's birthday, as they annually do. So it's kind of a strange message. They still show up, all of them too, right? Even though there's this friction that's building between them. I mean, let's look at it. We always try to look at things from the Central Asian point of view here. What does that say to the Central Asian, to the people of Central Asia, the citizens of their countries, that Russia makes nasty comments about things that they do, interferes with their policy, and yet when it's Putin's birthday, everyone's got to show up?
I mean, the fact that they show up to his birthday, I mean, the Central Asian governments, I'd say this, latest remarks, these episodes against, like we've been talking about discrimination and nationalist remarks from Russia, they have not, I don't think they've altered the relationship between the governments at the government level. But probably the global situation, but this is the war in Ukraine, has made the Central Asian governments more assertive when replying to this. This doesn't mean that at any point they're going to oppose or they're going to, Russia or deteriorate its links with Moscow. But they have a bit more of assertiveness compared to what they were before. But I don't think these remarks are going to change the way they interact let's say at a high level. Now, of course, the Central Asian citizens, even though they see these remarks, I think that the vast majority, and again, I don't have evidence for this, but anecdotally, they know that Russia's influence, and Ed already quoted some figures. Also, there's a generational divide. Perhaps more nationalist elements of the societies are not that comfortable with that, but they're still not. Any movement against Russia as a whole, or at a large extent, that we see. Against, there's no evidence, but this is more based on anecdotal evidence. So, on the one hand, the governments will continue regardless of these remarks. I mean, they've been standing these sort of remarks for years. I mean, it's true that they've increased in intensity and in the number since 2022, since the war in Ukraine. There's been more of a ultra-nationalist wave in Russia. So these remarks have definitely increased since then, but they're not new, right? We can go back to 2014, for instance, Putin questioning Kazakhstan's statehood, right? So it's nothing new. They've grown in intensity, but they're not. I don't think they're going to change that much any sort of relationship between the governments. Nonetheless, like I said at the beginning, now the Central Asia governments can reply with a more assertiveness that probably they wouldn't do in the past. But I think that's what's changed. But in terms of how this changes the relationship between between the region and Russia. I don't think it does. And from a social point of view, I think there's also other priorities that Central Asian citizens would like to focus on in everyday lives, rather than a Russian politician or official saying something and the Russian president going to Moscow for Putin's birthday. I think there's other priorities. At least that's how I see it.
Okay, thanks. Edward, these recent responses to comments that have come out of Russia or the treatment of migrant laborers, Central Asian migrant laborers in Russia, where is it being generated from? Do the governments in the region, do they sense that there's some popular disapproval that needs to be vented somehow, or is this purely on a government level?
I think it's very difficult to tell, but certainly, the increasing seniority of the people who've been involved in some of these statements, like the deal that Silov, as you said, in comments about the Eurasian Economic Union, indicate that, I think it's a combination of both. I think there certainly are people within the governments of Central Asia who are alarmed about, Russian chauvinism, or concerned about the situation facing migrants in Russia, about Russia's, invasion of Ukraine, and it's generally more disruptive criminal behavior. And so I think there is that concern from my kind of interactions with government officials. But at the same time, I think there's also that recognition that, particularly on the case of people like Alisher Kodirov, as Fran mentioned, that there is this appeal to segments of the population that are increasingly opposed to Russia, want to, not necessarily only opposed to Russia, but are supportive of their own nation and nation building, and are nationalists who view Russia as being one of the numerous others against which they're finding their identity. I think it's a combination of both, a genuine sentiment amongst some segments of the elite that there's a need to push back against some of these Russian statements, but at the same time, it's also not popular.
Thanks. Fran, kind of the same question. Let me rephrase this a little bit. In Russia, when people make these comments about Central Asia, whether it's Kazakhstan belongs to Russia, whether it's what language is official or what buildings are destroying or anything like that, they always attributed that to being the opinion of an individual, right? So, but at the same time, it's pretty much understood that they're expressing a semi-official view of the area, but more generally, the popular view. They're kind of appealing to their own population by saying this, right? This is the way they should treat Russia. This is the way they should remember Russia. Is this the flip side of the coin when they do this in Central Asia? Is this the government? The Central Asian government's having an individual give his opinion, knowing that it's going to be well received by the population?
I don't think it's a wrong idea. I mean, of course, we cannot prove it, but for me, it does make total sense. We mentioned Alisher Kodirov's words, aiming at more nationalist segment of population. That shows that actually, somebody in the country is responding to these remarks. But of course, this person is not in the government, right? So there's not going to be a diplomatic conflict per se. It's not a minister or president or something like this. It's just an MP, leader of a party, which is not in government. So it does make the total sense that, there's a way of addressing the venting sort of frustrations of some segments of the population, showing that something is being done or some sort of response is being given, although not officially by the government itself, but let's say of an official, an MP or politician in the country. So I think that is very true. I mean, of course, it will differ on the countries, but we're just talking about Uzbekistan, which is the most obvious case. I think we can clearly see that that happening as a very, and it's always the same person, so it's very clear who he targets. And even Kodirov, even during the presidential campaigns and all that, he's always made this sort of remarks. So he's always targeting, more nationalist Uzbek part of the population. And then, it can be used to vent the frustrations, to give some sort of unofficial answer to calm things at home. Because, for instance, you could argue if he had not made these remarks or, you know, answered every time, you know, any Russia official or academic or analyst, you know, threatens or interviews in Uzbekistan, you know, where would that frustration go? I mean, there could be people questioning, what are we doing about this? Nobody is standing up, you know, for us. So, you know, but in this case, we have that figure that, you know, okay, an answer has been given. And then let's move on. It doesn't create a diplomatic issue with Russia because it's, you know, it's a political figure, but it's not in government. And then, you know, let's go on with our lives as usual until the next remarks come from the Russian foreign ministry or some other politician or some other analyst. And then he can counteract that again and, you know, so on and so forth. As long as it doesn't go above that level, I think it's more of a way of venting potential frustrations of some segments of the population, definitely, yeah.
Okay, thanks. We're pretty much running to the end of time, but I'd like to get some last comments from both of you, and just, you know, your opinion on what the Central Asians actually starting to respond to these comments from Russia means for the relationship between Russia and these Central Asian countries. Have we reached a point where, as I mentioned in the middle, you know, is patience just running out? And is this going to be now something that's going to carry over for many years to come? Edward, I'll start with you.
I think it's certainly something that we can expect to continue to happen, as Russia's role in the region continues its long decline. Because I said before, certainly since the invasion of Ukraine, we've seen Russia strengthening its role in the region in certain ways. You know, the region's now become crucial to Putin's kind of continued demonstration of Russia's great power status. He frequently can visit, unlike many other parts of the world, where he'll participate in international summits and so on and so forth. You know, it's obviously become a site for sanctions evasion. So the region's become more and more important to Putin. But I think in general, what we're seeing is the region looking to diversify its ties with other countries. We're seeing a region in which the population is increasingly questioning the Soviet and imperial past and increasingly viewing Russia in negative terms. And I think that's something that we're going to continue to see. And governments of the region will continue to respond to this and increasingly push back against some of the more chauvinistic and threatening statements by Russian officials. I think it's only something we're going to see strengthen in the coming years.
Okay, thank you. Fran, I'm going to give you the last word. I mean, there's a lot of ties that bind Central Asia and Russia. Are some of the Central Asians cutting some of those, certainly in terms of how they view Russian government, the history with Russia and Russia's people?
I think the historical narratives, I think they're being revisited quite strongly, especially to regards to the early Soviet past. But of course, that's also a generational thing. I think it's sort of become, since the war in Ukraine, business as usual for every couple months to hear some of these remarks coming up from Russia. So it's becoming a bit of a new normality. So as such, Central Asian governments, they're being more assertive, but they're not overreacting. Now, well, I think it will be interesting to keep an eye on, and I agree with that. I think this is going to, you know, keep on going, for the near future, definitely. What will be interesting to keep an eye on is if, you know, either from a Russian point of view, the remarks are coming in by even more senior officials, which will be Putin or people even closer to him, and also from the responses from Central Asia, if it's going to go to at some point to a presidential level or similar. I think that would indicate a picture if their relationships are really souring because of this, which I don't think they will. But, you know, if we get to that point, then we would probably have to record another episode of the Mashalisa about that, because that would be signified as significant. That would mean we'd be looking at a significant change in their relationship. So that would, I would keep an eye on, you know, if this tit for tat is going to continue, is it going to be kept at the same level, and sort of, like I said, you know, business as usual, or is it going to escalate at some point? I have my doubts that it will, but, you know, of course, seeing how things have changed in the last couple of years, international relations, anything could happen. that would be my final those would be my final remarks.
Okay, great. Thank you. So, thank you, Edward, and thank you, Fran, for being on the program. We have run out of time. I'm sure we're going to come back to this topic again soon. And I'll be happy to have you both on the show. And of course, a big thank you as always to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mentalist podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mentalist podcast or the Central Asian Focus newsletter by visiting Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back soon. Bye-bye.